Okay, now we're beginning to zero in on the subject at hand. This is going to be a repeat of an article that we read last week. It's only a short bit, though, but we want to explain why we read this last week and clue you back in on something. Now, what they're talking about here, this is an article, by the way, that the research credit for this goes to Ted Rubenstein, and this came out of the London Daily Telegraph for Monday, April 22nd, 1985. The headline is Party-Going von Reibnitz, quote, ladies' man. Baron Gunther von Reibnitz, of course, is the one of these gentlemen. He's, in fact, Princess Michael of Kent's father, one of the people who has lately been scandalizing England by his connections to the royal family, despite his SS membership. Now, the article itself is talking about his sort of reputation as a dashing guy and things like that. But what is more interesting, of course, is where the exile community, the SS exile community, at least some of it, tended to wind up, and that's what we're going to look at. Anyway, once again, Party-Going von Reibnitz, quote, ladies' man, by our Johannesburg correspondent. Baron Gunther von Reibnitz kept his Nazi past a secret as he cut a dashing figure as a ladies' man in post-war South Africa and neighboring Mozambique. It was revealed in Johannesburg at the weekend. Many ex-Nazis are believed to have made their way to Southern Africa after the destruction of Hitler's Third Reich. In South Africa itself, elements of the ruling National Party, elected to power in 1948, had actively opposed the Allied war effort. And as a quick insert, I'll mention that we're going to get to that in some depth in a while. General Friedrich von Mellenthin, spelled M-E-L-L-E-N-T-H-I-N, chief of staff in the Western Desert to Field Marshal Rommel, and who now lives in Johannesburg, said this weekend, quote, shortly after arriving in South Africa in 1950, I was surprised one evening when I met Baron von Reibnitz at a party. I never knew what he'd done during the war and found out for the first time last week that he was in the SS. Baron von Reibnitz worked for an insurance company in South Africa and lived in a flat in Johannesburg's fashionable Killarney suburb, a predominantly Jewish district. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is not necessarily so much that von Reibnitz is connected to the royal family or that he lived in a predominantly Jewish suburb, which, of course, is ironic, but the world abounds in irony. What is interesting is the fact that, as this article is just one of many articles to mention, that there was a large migration out of what was then West Germany, but out of Germany at the end of World War II, to South Africa. And that in South Africa, not only did many of these people... Now, admittedly, probably some of the people who left Germany and went to South Africa were nothing other than just plain Germans, but there were also a lot of Nazis, and to use Dave's felicitous phrase, unreconstructed Nazis, and they basically went, as they did to South and Central America, they went and took their ideologies with them, but in very few places other than some of the real rat holes of South and Central America did they find governments that were so in sync, in sympathy with their viewpoints as they did in South Africa. And that's what we're going to be talking about essentially for the rest of the evening tonight. In some ways, what kind of a government is in South Africa and how is it put together, and what effect could that government have perhaps on the state of realpolitik today?
All right. In order to understand the South African government, we're going to step back and review some material that a long time and dedicated listeners to One Step Beyond have heard before. And for those of you who have heard this, patience, we're going to introduce some new material during the second prepared portion of the broadcast. But for the benefit of the relatively recent listeners or people who are just sort of tuning in or signing on here, we're going to go ahead and review a little bit about the origins of the South African government. Now, the key organization that you want to know about in with regard to South African political and cultural life is called the Broederbond, B-R-O-E-D-E-R-B-O-N-D, Broederbond. Basically, in Afrikaans, that means the Brotherhood. Now, that is a small but very, very powerful fascist organization which dominates the National Party of South Africa. Now, the National Party is the dominant political party of South Africa. The National Party controls all of South African political life. The Broederbond totally dominates the National Party. In addition, the Broederbond has infiltrated the educational system, the cultural life of the nation in every respect, so it's much more than just the government. The Broederbond essentially controls the entire fabric of South African society. Now, the Broederbond basically is an explicit fascist organization. They are Afrikaner nationalists. In other words, they are explicit racists who feel that the Afrikaner peoples, those of Afrikaner extraction in South Africa, are basically gifted and they view the Afrikaners as having a God-given right to dominate all of the other ethnic groups in South Africa. Now, the key element in the formation of the Bruderbund concerned its reorganization along the lines of the German Nazi Party, the NSDAP. Now, this happened prior to, just before World War II, and interestingly enough, the Bruderbund was reorganized along the lines of the German Nazi Party in conjunction with representatives from the Third Reich, with German spies, basically, or in conjunction with them. The main name that we want to be knowing about with regard to the South African end of this connection is a guy named D.F. Malan, last name M-A-L-A-N. Malan was not only the first Prime Minister of South Africa, but was head of basically was the author of something called the Wartime Draft Constitution. This basically was an Afrikaner constitution drawn up by the Bruderbund and other Afrikaner nationalist groups, and this wartime draft constitution drawn up by D.F. Malan served as the basis for the South African government as set up in 1948. Now, D.F. Malan was the fellow who established the working relationship between the Bruderbund and representatives of the Third Reich. Now, this relationship, this working relationship between the Bruderbund and Third Reich representatives, specifically a man named von Montmartin, M-O-N-T-M-A-R-T-I-N, was to result, as I indicated, in the reorganization of the Bruderbund along the lines of the organizational structure of the German Nazi Party, and that began a close working relationship between the German Nazi Party and the Bruderbund. Now, during World War II, the territory now called South Africa, the independent nation of South Africa, was a British colony. The Afrikaners tended to side with the Nazis against the British, and specifically the Bruderbund and many key members of it, including some men, as who, as Niptuck's going to read you in a couple of minutes, were to go on and become prime ministers of South Africa, fought or lent their efforts to the Axis cause. Now, of the relationship between the German Nazi Party and the Bruderbund, and the former's efforts in reorganizing the latter, we're going to read you from a book, or I'm going to read you from a book called The Rise of the South African Reich. The Rise of the South African Reich is authored by an exiled South African journalist named Brian Bunting, last name B-U-N-T-I-N-G. It was published in softcover by Penguin Books, specifically as part of the Penguin African Library, and was copyrighted 1968. So now I'm going to read you a short section about the reorganization of the Bruderbund by Brian Bunting from The Rise of the South African Reich. In an article in the Sunday Times on the 8th of March, 1964, Mrs. Janie Mallard, M-A-L-H-E-R-B-E, wife of South Africa's wartime director of military intelligence and herself a captain in military intelligence during the war, described the forces which had been at work in the Bruderbund during the 30s. This terrifying, octopus-like grip on the South African way of life was made possible by reorganizing the Bruderbund on the pattern of Hitler's highly successful Nazi state, complete with Führer, Gauleiters, group and cell leaders, spread in a sinister network over the whole of South Africa. This was initially planned by a high-ranking nationalist and two Stellenbosch students who were sent to Germany at Nazi expense to study the Nazi cell system. The man who planned this, in consultation with the then-nationalist leader Dr. Malan, was Graf von Durkheim Montmartin, M-O-N-T-M-A-R-T-I-N. The Nazi government had sent Montmartin to South Africa in 1934, ostensibly to attend an educational conference, but in reality, as was subsequently discovered from captured German documents, to consult secretly with Bruderbund leaders in order to foment a plan which would ensure that South Africa would side with Germany in the world war which Hitler was then already engineering. Mrs. Mallard writes, "The immediate result of this visit was the reorganization of the nationalist Bruderbund on the Nazi system, the main difference being that where Hitler reinvoked the rights of the German pagan gods to promote his ideologies, the nationalists Bruderbund declared that their plan of complete domination of white South Africa and absolute subjugation of the non-whites was an implementation of South Africa's God-given destiny. This was a clever ruse, for by its means, the powerful Dutch Reformed churches could be roped in." So again, Malan, heading up the nationalist organizations, including the Bruderbund, establishes a working relationship with the Third Reich, which results in the reshaping of the Bruderbund along the lines of the German Nazi Party and an active pattern of cooperation set up between the German Nazi Party and the Bruderbund. And recall that this very same D.F. Malan draws up the wartime draft constitution, which goes on to serve as the basic model for the South African government under the National Party. This also described in The Rise of the South African Reich by Brian Bunting. The Afrikaner Broederbaan, declared Lombard. By the way, Lombard is a pro-Afrikaner writer here, journalist. The Afrikaner Broederbaan, declared Lombard, is born from a deep conviction that the Afrikaner nation has been planted in this country by God's hand and is destined to remain here as a nation with its own character and its own mission. As will be seen later, these aims of the Broederbaan bear a striking resemblance to the notorious draft constitution for a future South African republic, which was drawn up by nationalist-oriented organizations during the war, and the basic principles of which have underlain the policy and actions of the Nationalist Party ever since it came to power in 1948.
Okay. Now, we're going to read a couple of more sections from another book. This book is called The Broederbaan, and it is written by Ivor Wilkins, I-V-O-R, Ivor Wilkins, and Hans Strydom, S-T-R-Y-D-O-M. This is copyright 1979, Paddington Press, distributed in the United States by Grosset and Dunlap. Okay, and again, we're going to be checking some of the early routes of the Broederbaan to power and some of the shaping and motive forces behind the Broederbaan. Okay, Wilkins and Strydom write, "The South African government today is the Broederbaan, and the Broederbaan is the government. No Afrikaner government can rule South Africa without the support of the Broederbaan. No nationalist Afrikaner can become prime minister unless he comes from the organization's select ranks." And select is right. I think by about 1977 or 78, when a lot of this information came from, there were only about 3,500, maybe a few more than that, but not less than 5,000 members in the Broederbaan. This is not a large organization like the Nazi Party got to be by the end of the war in Germany. This is a group of people who have elected to join to advance careers, not because they were forced to do it, because there were, you know, people sweeping the neighborhoods or anything. Mr. P.W. Botha, the current Prime Minister, is a member, as were his four predecessors, Dr. D.F. Malan, Advocate J.G. Strydom, spelled different than the author, S-T-R-I-J-D-O-M, Dr. H.F. Verwoerd, and Mr. John Voorster. Every member, except two, of the Botha cabinet is a Broederbaander. From this pinnacle of executive control over South Africa's affairs, the organization's 12,000 members, okay, my mistake, permeate every aspect of the Republic's life. Through its network of more than 800 cells in the villages and cities of South Africa, the organization has infiltrated members into town and city councils, school boards, agricultural unions, the state-controlled radio and television networks, industry and commerce, banks and building societies. Its membership spirals insidiously upward through the strata of South African society, into the provincial administrations, the departments of education, planning, roads and works, the hospital services, universities, the quasi-state corporations, the civil service, the national party caucuses, working through the administrators of the provinces, through parliament and the seat of government, until it finally reaches its apex in the office of the Prime Minister. And, as mentioned, the current Prime Minister, P.W. Botha, is himself a member of the Broederbaan, as well as all but two members of his cabinet at the time of the writing of this book.
And remember that all of his predecessors, including Malan, were also Broederbaan members.
That's right. Now, skipping back again, this is Dr. Malherbe, whose wife's writing Dave was reading from a little earlier. And they're talking again about the time, about World War II, and the relationship between South Africa and Britain and Germany, etc. Says Dr. Malherbe goes on, quote, "With South Africa's participation in the war, anti-British feelings flared up with renewed fervor. A number of prominent Afrikaner leaders became openly pro-Nazi and found expression of their ambitions in flamboyant organizations such as the Grey Shirts and the Osava Brandvag. The latter organization, under the leadership of Dr. Hans von Rensburg, was openly militant and opposed to General Smuts' war effort. He soon counted more members than there were in Smuts' army. Among these were a large number of teachers and even Dutch Reformed ministers. South Africa's former premier, Mr. Voorster, occupied a high position as assistant Hofkommandant. Dr. Verwoerd had strong Nazi sympathies, and his paper, The Transvaaler, was jubilant over the initial reverses of the Allied forces on land and sea. Likewise, it was filled with gloom when the Nazis started losing." Okay, and just to mention a couple of things real quickly, again, the fact that, as mentioned earlier by Dave in his reading, that this was the Broederbaan was an organization It was not only anti-British sentiment, such as was the case, say, in the Middle East and other places, that was operating in terms of these people's desire to support the Nazis. This was an organization, as mentioned, that was largely set up on the Nazi model, in fact, with direct contact between Hitler's state and Hitler's party and the South Africans who eventually came to power in 1948. The other thing I think that is of some interest is, again, now looking at the cohesiveness and the power of these people, which still rather a small minority of a tiny minority within the country, okay? The whites are only some 10-12% of the people in South Africa, or maybe as much as 20, but still a small minority in the country, and the figure given 12,000 members of the Bruderbund, and yet through some very key contacts, and they're being involved in different levels of government and communication media and things like that. They are able to exercise basically a vice-like grip on the government of that country that has not been broken since 1948 and has been literally seamless. Now, again, this is not to suggest that everything in the world can be traced back to a ruling organization, but I think that if we look at, say, for instance, the fact that before the P2 scandal broke in Italy, the fact that a rather small group of very influential people were literally running Italy without even having the benefit of being in power. They were not the government, but they ran the government. Again, a small group of fascists with like-minded ideas. Here in South Africa, there's a group that is so much in charge that they, in fact, are the government as well as being the motive force. Now, again, you can use this and examine our current situation in the United States any way that you want to. But again, remember, what gives these people power is not numbers. Not numbers. They're vastly outnumbered within their own country. They're outnumbered among their own ethnic group by non-members. But the fact is that they have control of vital organs of communication, important organs of finance, and, in fact, key posts in the government and intelligence fields. And that seems to be where the power stems from.
And remember that the people who hold this power are essentially not only ideological clones of the Nazis, but were closely associated with them when the German Nazis were on the offensive during World War II. And basically, the implications of having an organization like this running South Africa, we're going to talk about later in the broadcast. Remember that Forrester and Verward, two of the gentlemen that Niptok read you about, actually worked on behalf of the Nazis, and the Bruderbund was basically formed along the lines of the German Nazi Party. That's the organization we're talking about that has all of this power in South Africa. A lot of people have described South Africa as being the Fourth Reich. Jesse Jackson, among others, used that term. It's worth noting in this context, and as we're going to see later in the broadcast, it not just is the Fourth Reich, but it's actually an outgrowth of the Third.
It might be the Third and a Half Reich. One of the things, of course, we're also going to be looking at and talking about, and hopefully you will be talking about with us, is South Africa's rather strange bedfellows type of connections with Israel, and also the perhaps not so strange bedfellows, but just as vital, if not more so, connections with West Germany, especially those beginning immediately after World War II. Again, we had some calls that dovetailed right in with some of the things that we're going to talk about. You will remember in the first part of the broadcast, we were reading essentially, among other things, we did some reading on South Africa, talked about the founding of the Bruderbund, which is the sort of internal political party of South Africa to which the last four prime ministers and virtually all the important South African governmental figures and industry figures and things like that, or at least a very large percentage of them belong, an organization that was formed with the Nazi Party ideal in mind, obviously a staunchly racist organization, and an organization which, as we saw with 12,000 members, nonetheless manages to dominate a country of several million people, 70% of whom are not allowed to vote, of course, which certainly helps. But we also talked about a bit about South Africa's place in the world, and one of our callers brought up the subject of South African nuclear capability, especially in light of the staunchly, I guess you call it, not even quite crypto-fascist nature of the government that they have there in South Africa. And this is, in fact, what we're going to talk about a little bit here and some things that we're going to read. The first is a Jack Anderson column from the San Francisco Chronicle for Friday, April 26th, 1985. The article, the Jack Anderson column, is headlined, South Africa's Bomb Tests. It goes as follows. The United States had prior knowledge that South Africa and Israel would explode a small nuclear device in the fall of 1979, an investigation we have conducted over the last 5 years indicates. An aging U.S. Vela satellite, spelled V-E-L-A, brought to monitor nuclear detonations, picked up the double-pulse flash of light characteristic of a nuclear blast on September 22, 1979, beginning a controversy that still has not ended. 2 months later, in November 1979, a White House scientific panel, in a report that was not made public until the following year, maintained that the satellite sighting was not a nuclear explosion at all, but some other occurrence. But the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency were certain that the Vela had indeed detected a nuclear blast. In secret testimony to Congress, the month after the event, CIA officials identified Israel as the party most likely responsible, with South Africa the runner-up. In January 1980, the CIA gave Congress a little more information. A contingent of the South African Navy was in the South Atlantic area near the place at the time of the explosion. Then in June 1980, a secret CIA report to the National Security Council said the explosion was probably a tactical 2 or 3 kiloton weapon detonated by Israel and South Africa. But the CIA didn't share some of its secrets with Congress or with the White House panel investigating the blast. From land, sea, and air surveillance by humans, submarines, and satellites, respectively, U.S. intelligence established that Israel and South Africa were working together on a bomb as early as 1966. In fact, in August 1977, tipped off initially by the Soviets, no less, the United States announced that the South Africans were about to test a nuclear device in the Kalahari Desert. Diplomatic and public outcry led to the cancellation of the test. For the next 2 years, the CIA kept track of a steady stream of visits to South Africa by Israeli nuclear scientists, technicians, and defense officials. The clincher for the CIA was the arrival in South Africa of an American expatriate who was believed to have shared his knowledge of U.S. nuclear weaponry with the Israelis and then, at their behest, with the South Africans. 2 years later, in Antarctica, a Navy official confided to Dale Van Atta that 2 U.S. spy planes had tried to approach the nuclear test area, but were turned away by the South Africans and had to land secretly in Australia.
Okay, now the main thing that we're going to be focusing on today concerns this evening for the second prepared portion of the broadcast, essentially concerns the development of the South African nuclear industry. Now, South Africa has done a great deal of work in conjunction with Israel on nuclear weapons. They've also cooperated very closely with the United States, Britain, and France, too, in various aspects of the nuclear question. The dominant factor, the most important thing to know about in assessing South Africa's nuclear capability, the main thing you want to know about is a uranium enrichment process, which South Africa has, which basically grants it a great deal of autonomy within the nuclear community, because South Africa has not signed any of the international treaties concerning nuclear proliferation. They have always been one of the countries with the largest uranium reserves or deposits, basically, in the ground, a major supplier of uranium ore. South Africa now has a uranium enrichment process, which makes it a force to be reckoned with within the nuclear family. Now, the main thing that the main concern in getting South Africa its uranium enrichment process was West Germany. West Germany has the best relations with South Africa of any Western nation. Recall in the first portion of the program we talked about the large Nazi expatriate community in South Africa. There is a very large German community in South Africa. Third Reich veterans comprise a significant element of that. There is a very close and long-standing pattern of cooperation between West Germany, the Federal Republic, and South Africa. Specifically, for example, in 1976, fiscal year 76, 70% of all of West Germany's industrial export credits for Western nations went to South Africa. There's also a very close working relationship between the two countries with regard to military matters. West Germany builds a lot of South Africa's weapon systems. There's close consultation between the military staffs of both countries. And in particular, the German South African community has been directly responsible for a number of different transactions between the two countries. Now, in order to understand how South Africa got its uranium enrichment process, you have to know about West Germany. And in turn, in order to understand West Germany's nuclear industry, you have to understand the IG Farben chemical cartel, the Nazi-affiliated, the chemical cartel which provided the backbone of German wartime production. And a person has to know about the other large companies in Nazi Germany which provided the backbone of German manufacturing during the Third Reich, because these companies and their links to Western nations are essentially the main companies involved in the development of the West German nuclear industry. And in turn, the West German nuclear industry is the key to understanding how South Africa gets its uranium enrichment process, and that's the main thing with regard to the South African nuclear capability. So the first thing we're going to talk about here concerns the development of the West German nuclear industry. We're going to be talking about the close pattern of cooperation between West Germany and South Africa. We're going to be reading from a book called The Nuclear Axis. That book is co-authored by Barbara Rogers, R-O-G-E-R-S, and a man named Zdenek Cervenka, Zdenek Cervenka, who basically is from the Scandinavian Institute of African Affairs. And Barbara Rogers formerly was with the British Foreign Office and was a consultant to the UN. Their book, Rogers and Cervenka's book, The Nuclear Axis, published in hardcover by New York Times Books, copyrighted 1978. Now, in the Nuclear Axis, basically there's a discussion of a fellow named Grote, G-R-O-T-H. This fellow was basically in charge of a group of centrifugists who were involved with enriching uranium for Nazi Germany. This man, Grote, G-R-O-T-H, is the main name to know about with regard to uranium enrichment on behalf of Nazi Germany. This fellow worked for the IG Farben chemical cartel, and after the defeat of Nazi Germany, he and his fellows were put back to work by a government-sponsored body in the budding Federal Republic. It wasn't even incorporated at that point. And they basically went right back to work doing the research that they were originally doing, trying to develop a nuclear capability for the Third Reich. They then undertook exactly that same thing on behalf of the Federal Republic. In the Nuclear Axis, Rogers and Cervenka write, "In 1949, the wartime centrifugists under Professor Grote, G-R-O-T-H, were funded to continue their experiments by the Emergency Association for German Science. Grote is now the senior centrifugist in the Federal Republic. Leading financial roles in the Emergency Association were assumed in 1949 by representatives of Metallgesellschaft AG and Gute Hoffnungsschütte AG, both companies heavily involved in the West German nuclear industry and the centrifuge troika. Both, of course, have strong historical and cross-ownership ties with IG Farben and the industrial complex which helped to ensure Hitler's access to power and then formed a vital part of the Nazi war machine. After the war, it was industrialist Friedrich Flick, F-L-I-C-K, in prison for war crimes at the time, who organized secret uranium prospecting by the Eisenwerk Maximilianschütte AG in the Fichtenberge, northeast of Nuremberg, in contravention of occupation regulations. This was done in collaboration with the American authorities, who presumably placed the need for uranium for the American nuclear weapons stockpile above the need to eliminate the traces of Nazi aspirations for a nuclear capability." So, again, Grote, originally working on behalf of IG Farben, the top centrifugist, goes to work for the Federal Republic after the war, and Friedrich Flick, a top Nazi industrialist who used liberal amounts of slave labor in his industrial enterprises, is illegally mining uranium in Germany while in prison, having been sentenced by the Nuremberg Tribunal. This uranium, in turn, is used to enrich, among other things, to fuel the growing American nuclear capability. Okay, so the German nuclear program gets its start not only from IG Farben and Professor Grote and the wartime centrifugists, but also from the illegal mining by a Nazi industrialist while in prison, having been sentenced by the Nuremberg Tribunal, who's mining uranium for the United States. And Friedrich Fleck is a name which has a great deal of significance for those of us under the Reagan administration.
Yes, a variety of reasons for that. Of course, the Fleck Group, probably the largest conglomerate currently under one roof in Germany at the moment, is undergoing a series of scandals for the fact that it turns out that they've owned the last four or five governments in Germany, including the current one, Helmut Kohl's